This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Timps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're talking all about value as a factor in mental health. And some of our themes are easier to explain than others. But this one, I'm particularly glad it's so broad and open to interpretation because we got into so many areas talking with today's guest, Dr. Joseph Schrand. And it was an interview I took a lot from because, you know, here on the show, I talk about language around mental health a lot. I think if my producer's feedback, Pete, is anything to go by, I think I talk about language a lot in general. It's very much a fascination of mine. And I think we could put a lot of that down to the dyslexia, which creates this like weird dichotomy of like the fascination in the very thing that you find difficult, that, you know, spelling vexes me, but I love using long words. I just try and avoid writing them down. And whilst I was probably never going to pass English at school, I'm glad that I studied it. I find it really interesting. And I bring up language because I think the way today's guest approaches it and the kind of insights he shared on where the future of diagnoses and conversations around mental health in a clinical setting could be going, really valuable. And, oh, I accidentally mentioned the theme name. That was on purpose. Anyway, I found it really interesting because I think it slightly differs from maybe the approach we have here on the show, which is a little bit more hard-hitting about stigma, and therefore my slant is slightly more, yes, certain language can be seen in a particularly negative light, like having disorder in the name of certain conditions, but that's no justification for stigma. There may be certain words that are seen as negative, but that's no justification for any negative treatment around them. And then it should be that the priority is on accuracy. In the same way, we try and not shy away from using the term mental illness because it has its own specific meaning. And there is a set of mental illnesses, which are worth noting distinctly from mental health, which is a broader term. And we talk about more like a spectrum, that you can be anywhere on it, whereas a mental illness is something specifically diagnosable as part of where you fit on the mental health spectrum. So there's an importance to the difference between such language. And so for me, I'm like, no, we shouldn't shy away from terms like mental illness, even if some people have a wariness maybe there or a more out-and-out stigma. That's very much been my approach, but I was interested talking to today's guest because he made so many compelling points on a bit of a different slant to me on some of this stuff. And so part of the reason I bring up all of this now is because I would very much like to invite you, the listeners, to get in touch with us via email, through our website, and let me know what you think of today's conversation, because we are constantly looking to evolve and improve what we do. And maybe this is one of the areas where I'm like, okay, what's next? How do we approach these conversations and the language specifically that I care so much about getting right going forward? So please let me know what you think of that part of the conversation, or indeed the conversation in general, because I found it a really impactful interview. I found it a very uplifting conversation. And I found particularly what Dr. Joe shares as part of his methodology as a psychiatrist really interesting in terms of not judging clients and finding the balance between you could be in a better place and there is things that medicine and all kinds of support and lifestyle changes can do to bring you to a better place, but that does not mean you are bad for being in a bad place. And we know that here on the show, but this was a new way of describing and approaching that, which I don't know, maybe it's me as someone that's not always the best in the winter months. I was like, oh, I maybe needed to hear some of that lately. So good chat. And at some point in the future, I will be going on Dr. Joe's radio show. So I will be getting to chat to him again soon. But for now, I'll give you a bit more introduction into our guest. And I've got something to read, especially. So Dr. Joe is an expert. Oh, I have to say, in the pitch document we got for him, he was referred to as Dr. Joe. Like, so the first paragraph was his like full name. And then the next one was Dr. Joe in brackets, as he's affectionately known to most people. So as soon as I saw that, not only did I think, oh, love it, I was also like, well, of course I have to call him Dr. Joe. So cool. So Dr. Joe is an expert in addiction and child therapy and is creator and founder of Drug Story Theatre, an innovative program that teaches improvisational theatre to teens in the early stages of addiction recovery. He is also the medical director of Road to Responsibility, a program that treats adults with developmental difficulties, and he serves on the American Board of Addiction Medicine. So very busy, accomplished guy. Dr. Joe is also a frequent contributor to sites like Psychology Today, and you can find more of his writing via his new book, which we talk about in the end of today's episode. But for now, please enjoy this conversation all about value and what that means within a mental health context. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out. None of us can know what the new year will hold, but one thing you can commit to is a better shave with Harry's. I know only too well how expensive razors can be as someone with a small army of different ones lined up in the bathroom. So was delighted to find out about a brand so committed to value and quality they launched with their own factory and have since won over 20 million customers. So what does Harry's offer that other brands don't? Well, with 5 precision engineered blades, an ergonomically weighted handle, and a rich lather shave gel, you'll get the close and comfortable shave that every ad promises. All that for less than half the price of the nearest 5-blade brand. Support our podcast and get your trial set delivered to you, including a razor handle, 5-blade cartridge, foaming shave gel, and a travel blade cover by going to harrys.com/mentalhealth. That's harrys.com/mentalhealth. You'll just pay for the shipping for the trial, so there's nothing to lose but a more comfortable face to gain. Emails, laundry, groceries. There's a lot on your to-do list, but what should be at the top? And what if the answer is you? This year, put yourself first with the help of Dipsy. Dipsy Stories believes in less analysing and more feeling your feelings. Less stressing and more easing into things. Less scrolling and more savouring the moment. Less pressure and more pleasure. Dipsy Stories is an app full of sexy audio stories where you can close your eyes and let yourself get lost in a world where only good things happen and pleasure is always and pleasure is your only priority. It's a way to explore your fantasies in a safe, shame-free way. And they also have wellness. And they also have wellness sessions to help you wind down and explore, and sleep sessions to help you drift off. For listeners of our show, Dipsy is offering an extended 30-day free trial when you go to dipsystories.com/health. That's 30 days of full access for free when you go to dipseastories.com/health. Go get it.
So Bobby and Danny, thank you so much for having me here today. As you know, I'm Dr. Joe Schrand. What are the first sort of mental health memories? I'll give you the first one. I was probably maybe 3 or 4 years old, and I remember looking into a mirror and wondering who was looking back and realizing it was me, that I was me. And I don't know whether people appreciate what that really means, because all of a sudden, there I am, 3 or 4 years old, and recognizing that I had a brain. The next memory was probably when I was like 5 or 6 years old. And at this point, I had a deep crush on this girl. I still remember her name, Claire. I won't say her last name. This happened to be in England, by the way, because I was born in Cape Town. I was growing up in England. And it was sometime around November, and I was going to visit Claire. And it was on a small street in the London area. And I just felt sad. I didn't know why. I didn't know whether it had to do with Claire, with me, with what was going on in my family, because there was a lot of anger and disrespect in my family between my parents. And I just remember that feeling sad. Over the next decades, on and off, I have felt that sadness. And have now been able to reflect on what does that really mean? Why do human beings feel sad at all? And it leads into the commonality that we all have. Because not everybody gets depressed, but everyone gets sad. Not everybody experiences panic, but everyone worries. Not everybody may experience psychosis with complete distortion of thinking, but everyone on some time has wondered, what is that person thinking about me? So there are other experiences, but truly the pivotal ones were these early ones. And then there are so many different things that were going on in my family in terms of mental health. One more story. I know they're long stories, but remember, you've asked a psychiatrist to speak, and we usually listen. So when we do speak, we don't stop. So I remember it was the beginning of medical school, and I lived out in Cincinnati. I was engaged, and my future wife and I decided we should both go into our own therapy. I'd had therapy on and off through high school. So I go into my therapist, you know, a young psychiatrist, and I start telling him about my family history. That, you know, my father had some depression. My mother had depression. My sisters at times had depression, anxiety. And this psychiatrist says to me, you know, you are at high risk for significant mental illness. I thought, whoa. You know? And I went home and I told my future wife this. I said, you know, I told my psychiatrist about these different things, and he said that I was at high risk for significant mental illness. And my future wife said to me, I knew that. I said, wait a sec. You know and knew that I am at high risk for significant mental illness? She said, well, yeah, I mean, I know about your dad, your mom, your sisters. I said, wait, so you know this and you're willing to marry me anyway? She said, well, yeah. I said, well, you're crazier than I am. So that was really one of the other memories, is how do you integrate your own experiences into your life? And that's part of why I'm here, Bobby, and why I'm so delighted to be talking with you about how we can destigmatize this thing we call mental illness. Or is it really mental health? Or is there anything wrong at all?
Wow. No, thank you for those. And I want to pick up firstly on that point with the second anecdote you shared, because that's a wonderful example of how, as much as we're here battling stigma week in, week out with this podcast, sometimes it can be that brilliantly simple that you'd met somebody where you'd, by contrast, soaked up a certain amount of stigma, not even realizing it. Growing up around mental illness, having a firsthand understanding of the human impact and the day-to-day real life challenges of that. And you very much love those people in your life, and yet you can still have those negative societal perceptions that are so prevalent. And then you meet somebody that knows these people in your life even less and has such a wonderfully refreshing, of course you wouldn't stigmatize, approach. And I love that. And I think for me and a lot of people, it takes a long time to get to that place, to unpick some of the internalized stigma I'd picked up. And so I love that anecdote, as, yeah, we really can at times just not stigmatize, just make that choice and just live that life.
I could not agree more. And this is exactly what my whole work is about. It's everything about that. Because why do we even consider something like mental illness? I mean, think of the words that we use. You know, we're going to dive right into this, but in psychiatry, because, you know, I'm here in the United States, folks, and I'm board certified in adult psychiatry, child psychiatry, and addiction medicine. And I always get astonished how we use the word disorder to describe people. Borderline personality disorder, major depressive disorder, attention deficit disorder. Well, words are important. As soon as you use the word disorder, you're separating people into two groups. One group is okay, and one group is not. And then we're astonished we have stigma. We have been perpetuating this without even realizing it by using these words in our field. So I use the word condition. And I know that that's beginning to be picked up more because these words are so important. If you keep saying, this person has a disorder, we want to treat them, you're implying they're broken and they need to be fixed. And I don't think anyone's broken. I think we're all doing the best we can at every moment with the potential to change in the very next second to another best we can. And I don't know whether people can see this, but I just want you to know Bobby was smiling. As soon as I said that, he started to smile. So what was that smile for?
Well, the reason for the smile is this is absolutely such an important conversation. And so I'm so glad you brought it up. But it is not always the easiest one to have. And I'm always cautious of, as someone that's not from a medical background myself, having too strong opinions on what conditions should be called. So I think my approach is very much to have a neutral mentality towards the illnesses, to use that word. And if we can do that, and if we can unpick a lot of the stigma, then we can be in a place where a lot of that automatic association, this illness, therefore bad, is removed. But absolutely, I agree with what you're saying. And I'm glad that you as a medical professional carrying that bit of the torch of saying, but there is also work that can be done to change the medical language. And, you know, I think of an example that I use in my own life around, I will often refer to someone having experienced or they are experiencing depression, as opposed to what you so often see written and said, which is they struggle with it. And it's that sort of negative assumption. And as someone that's lived with depression for as long as I know, I have struggled with it. But also, I've had plenty of days where I'm fine. And so is it an ongoing factor in my mental health? Yes. Is it always a negative and only a negative? No.
It's refreshing to be on a show where people think this way. It really is, because, you know, there's so much sense of devaluation in this. And part of the difficulty was stigma. What is stigma really, if not a mistrust? Just think about this for a moment. If this person is disordered, therefore they are unpredictable. Their behaviors are unpredictable. And as a human being, I'm interested in safety. One of the things. And as that safety, I need to know what that person is going to do. And if I can't anticipate what they will do, then I won't trust them. And that is part of what stigma is about, is we lump people into these groups where if you're not like me, then I can't trust you. It's not just confined, of course, to mental health. It's part of what we're doing throughout the world right now in terms of our societies, where tribalism has come in and just separated us at a time where we could be so united.
For sure. And it's interesting even picking up on this with you, because I would say nearly every psychiatrist I've talked to has shared quite a similar sentiment, because you're dealing with a particular type of stigma, which I think can be very blatant in a way that many people luckily don't experience, where I'm sure you've probably had times when people have said, oh, I couldn't work with people like that. Or, you know, I hope it doesn't affect you, you know, as if it's something that's going to catch through your work. And so perhaps because you're a professional and you are the one treating as opposed to the one being treated, there's that assumption that certain things can be said to you. And I think that's part of the reason why when I talk to other psychiatrists, I hear similar things about, you know, the language and the ridiculous things people say.
You know, I hear a lot about people talking to each other. But don't we really want to talk with each other? To see, again, the small difference in the word. Talking to someone doesn't always create that dyadic bond. But when you talk with someone, you are listening. And as soon as you listen to someone and you're talking with them, it changes their brain. And this is the other thing that you know, as a psychiatrist, my early experiences were not in psychiatry. My early experiences were in the theater. And I was an actor. I did a lot of acting. And then I got into this thing in college called sociobiology. It was just coming out. Guy E.O. Wilson, unfortunately, just passed away, wrote this book, Sociobiology, which is the genetics of behavior. It was looking at why people are doing what they're doing, but from a biological genetic component. So instead of just looking at the genes that, you know, code for blue eyes, are there genes that code for certain behaviors? Do we behave in certain ways that are really Darwinian and about survival? And when you take a look at it that way, what does that really imply about human behavior? That everyone is just trying to do the best they can. They just might not get it right. But there isn't an illness. There isn't pathology. No one is broken. We just might not get it right.
Yeah. And that's something that I talk about a lot on the show is because we have certain mechanisms within what makes us human that protect us from threat, then when those reactions are severe enough to be categorized as mental illness, is that abnormality? So an example we've talked about before is PTSD, that so much of the PTSD response is protecting you from the severity of that trauma that you may not have been able to be protected from, let's say, the physical thing that might have happened, but there are ways in which your mind can deal with the severity of what you witnessed, what you went through, and prevent that trauma from being built on in certain ways through, you know, further triggering events. And, you know, that's a part of a very human process. And so it really then, if you look at it that way, becomes more about have you experienced a trauma of that level that's then brought on that level of response or not, as opposed to are you an ill person or a well person?
So why do we call it a disorder? You're absolutely right. We have a stress response. Right? Something traumatic happens to us. It activates a very ancient part of our brain, the limbic system. This limbic system responsible for irrational thought, for emotions. It's where memories live. Happens to be where addictions start as well. But it's ancient. It is almost the reptilian brain is what some people call it. And we activate that when we feel under threat. So we have the fight, flight, freeze response. I mean, we're not that different than other animals, right? So what's fight? So fight is when you're confronted with a predator and you know you can beat it. So you will approach it and try to fight it and get it to run away. And in humans, that's anger. Anger is an emotion designed to change things. We get angry when we want somebody to do something different. Start doing something, stop doing something. That's the fight branch. Flight. You know you're faced with a predator and you know you're not strong enough to beat it. So you just want to get the hell out of there. In humans, that's anxiety, an avoidance emotion. But then sometimes you're faced with a predator that you know you're not strong enough to beat and you're not fast enough to get away from. So the next best option is to freeze and try to become invisible and hope the danger passes. And I think in humans, that's depression, where you're faced with this overwhelming predator, whatever it may be, and you just can't get away from it. So you shut down. But human beings have evolved three new F's. instead of fight, flight, freeze, we have family, friendship, fellowship, and if you're not very good at spelling, physician, but where we share the worry with each other. We are social animals. And this is the key to what is really going on in our brain as a social animal, because we weren't always a social animal. We were these isolated mammals scurrying around. We weren't the biggest animal. We weren't the fastest. We weren't the strongest. We were these isolated mammals scurrying around, hoping not to be lunch. We were prey. And then we formed these small social groups. And our survival potential increased so dramatically that human beings are now everywhere. But to access the protection of that group, you have to contribute to that group, which means you have to have value. Whenever we feel that we are being devalued, it will activate that primitive limbic response, a survival response. Am I still valuable enough to access the protection of my group? That's what's happening. And then we use the word disorder, and we say, we're separating you from our group. Whoa. We shouldn't be surprised at the response.
I love that way of describing it. And also, I think that is a big part of explaining why there can be such prevalence of certain conditions, why modern day life can be so difficult, because we have that threat, if we call it that, of social exclusion, of rejection, of being cast out. We have that crowdsourced, because we can go on any social media app of our choosing and see people arguing about important topics that affect us personally. And so then you find the same feelings come up. You know, which side am I on? Which tribe do I belong to? What happens if things change? You know, all these people think opposite to me. What if they are in power next? What if they make the laws? And so that constant access to information is so incredible. But if you're looking for a reason to fear, if that is as part of, like you say, our remaining survival instincts that have continued so strongly in people, even at times when, you know, they're not as necessary, we don't have predators to run from in the same way, but we still have this innate detection system for where is the threat. And the threat is so easy to find, because we only need to open our phone and we're already addicted to that anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's kind of mind-blowing, isn't it, in some ways, when you really think about this. Depending on what source of information I have will influence what I think and feel. But the thing is, if that's happening to me, it's happening to everyone. And as soon as you shift your brain to that, you realize how much we have in common. Because human beings have evolved a new part of our brain, right? There's the neocortex. Neo is new, cortex is brain, our new brain. And in particular, right behind your forehead is the prefrontal cortex. This is the part of the brain that may be the most modern in evolution. It is the part of the brain responsible for rational thought, as opposed to the limbic system for irrational thought. It's the part of the brain that's responsible for solving problems and making a plan, as opposed to being impulsive like the limbic. It's responsible for anticipating what will happen next, as opposed to memory, what has happened before. And so, how many times have you done something impulsively, limbically, and slapped your forehead as if you're trying to jumpstart your prefrontal cortex? What was I thinking? This is our new brain. This is the part of the brain that we can now harness. Because the limbic system, we need it. We need it for survival. There's no question. It is a critical, imperative part of our brain. But if we keep being limbic, what will happen next? So one of my phrases is keep it frontal, don't go limbic, right? you're going to activate your limbic system. You're going to feel these things, but then you can step back and reflect. Why did I feel that way? What just happened? I can be reflective instead of reflexive. I can anticipate what will happen next if I do this now. That's cool. Because again, we can all do that. What will happen next if we continue to have this disparity? If we continue to be tribalism? We're actually one tribe. It's called humanity. And one of my other phrases, contribute to humanity to help retain your sanity. When you contribute, you are actually helping yourself, because we all want the same thing. We all just want to feel valued by somebody else. Think about every person you've ever met. Listeners, think about every person you've ever met. The common thread that binds us is we just want to feel valued by somebody else. It's true. And what's cool is that every and any moment, you can remind someone of their value. And whenever you remind someone of their value, you increase your own value. How cool is that? Imagine what will happen next. Use your prefrontal cortex. When we have a world where instead of increasing our value by decreasing somebody else's, and then being astonished that we've activated their limbic response of fight, flight, freeze. What happens next when we increase our value by reminding somebody else of theirs? That's the world that I'm hoping we can get to. And that's the world I am sure we can. Look, my last name is Schrand. I get Schrandiose, it's true. But I really believe this. I believe we can do this together.
Me too. And, you know, that's part of what's got me through certain times in my life, that clinging to that belief and that optimism that things can be better. And in many ways, we do see that. We were talking off air even before we started recording about some of the opportunities we've seen, even through the depths of the pandemic, where people have had a chance to refocus on why issues around loneliness are so important to be addressed, why we need each other so much and in a way that is beyond digital. You know, why us looking out for each other's health is absolutely important right now, but it wasn't unimportant before.
That's right. And this global pandemic, the fact that it's global, what does that really mean in terms of what separates us compared to what unites us? Everyone's susceptible to this. Even the people who don't believe it's real, you may still be susceptible to it. And yeah, it has brought an awareness, which I think is so wonderful. I'm hearing more about mental health than mental illness. You know, we need people to have their mental health. How cool is that? The people are starting to think, wow, so depression, anxiety, these are not disorders? No, of course not. This is a part of who you are as a human being, you know. Now, I'm not dismissing any of the people's experiences, not at all. I'm not dismissing what it feels like to be anxious or feels like to be depressed or feels like, you know, to have substance use. I'm not dismissing them, but I am saying to you, as soon as you recognize that this is not a sign of being broken, let's understand it. And this, of course, gets into the whole I am approach.
That's what I was going to ask you about next. Yeah.
Oh, go my ahead. God. Incredible. Go ahead. I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, all I was ready to say is I think this links very much to your work with the I am approach of how we can link together people's value, their mental health, and where each of us are at in terms of what we can expect from each other and also what we should expect from ourselves. Because I think, I don't know the science, but you can tell me if this is right. I would imagine from what you've described that the neocortex is also where this phenomenon exists of us being able to judge ourselves. Because I talk about that a lot, as humans have this distinct thing where we can have a feeling and then we can judge that feeling and then the feeling gets worse. And so I think that's one of the things I love most about your I am approach, because it removes that layer of expectation of where you should be in terms of your mental health. So with that set up, you can tell the listeners what it actually is.
Thank you, Bobby. The I am approach, the idea is no one is broken. We're all doing the best we can at every moment in time. I call this your I am. This is my current maximum potential. This is who I am. This is me. And I matter. So you can use whichever thing you want for I am. But I'll tell you how this started. Is back in 1982, so 40 years ago, I had finished college. I decided I wanted to go to medical school. And I had to do my pre-med studies. And when you're doing pre-med, one of the things you have to take is physics. Listeners, you guys still awake? Because whenever I say physics, people immediately fall asleep. But in physics, the symbol capital I stands for potential current. It's part of an equation for electricity. But I thought, why don't we just turn it upside down? And we call it a current potential. And what if we look at everyone at a maximum current potential, doing the best we can at this moment in time, with the potential to change in the very next second to another I am, to another current maximum potential. But we are responding to and influenced by four domains. This takes the chaos of life and we organize it with these four domains. Your home domain. No one's going to argue your home has had an influence on who you are. You know, I've listened to some of your podcasts and this opening of people telling their stories. How many of them are influenced by their home domain? Something that happened at home. So the home domain. Then there's the social domain, which is the rest of the world. That's you and I chatting here, that's driving down the road, that's going to a store, that's being in school, that's being at work, that's everything other than the home domain. And you can appreciate that stuff that happens at home has an influence on things that happen in the social domain. And stuff that happens in the social domain can influence things at home. So these two domains are outside, your home and your social domain. And then the two internal domains, the biological domain of your brain and body. Are you hungry? Are you tired? Are you digesting lunch? And then what I called the IC domain, my current concept of myself. Just like the I am is my current maximum potential, here's my current concept. How do I see myself? But more importantly, how do I think other people see me? And we've been talking about this. Human beings are very interested in what other people think or feel. We call that empathy. How are you feeling? But what we really want to know is, what are you thinking about me? Do you see me as valuable? How do you see me? What I didn't realize when I created this back in 82, because I didn't know about something called the biopsychosocial model, which is a fancy way of talking about medicine now. This guy Engel created it in the 70s. The biopsychosocial model moved us away from the medical model to say, this is how a person is sick and diseased. It's not just their biology. It's what's happening in their world. But the IC domain extends it. Because what I didn't realize when I created the I am approach was I was talking about something called theory of mind. Theory of mind, we can't see someone's mind, so we have to guess and theorize, what are they thinking or feeling? It is the root of empathy. But what we really want to know is, what are you thinking about me? And I can tell you a little bit about how I came to that at another time. But the I am is saying, here we are. I'm doing the best I can at this moment in time in response to these four domains. But it doesn't mean I have to like my I am. It doesn't mean I have to condone it. It's not a free ride. Just because it's the best you can do at that moment doesn't mean you're not responsible. And responsibility is different than blame. Responsibility is empowering. But you are responsible. And it doesn't even mean you're going to win and be successful. Some people's success is when you love going to work and love going home. For some people, success is having food in the refrigerator. For some people, success is having a home to have a refrigerator. For some people, success is just being able to get up and get through the day. But instead of judging yourself as broken and less than, should be doing better, not good enough, let's look again at why you do what you do based on the influence of these four domains. And think about these words, Bobby, look again, and just reverse them. Again, look. Again, to repeat something. Look like a spectator. The I am is saying, let's respect why people do what they do based on the influence of the four domains. When's the last time you got angry at someone treating you with respect? Right? Right? Never, right?
Yeah.
Because anger is an emotion designed to change things. We get angry when we want somebody to do something different, but being respected feels great. So we don't get angry. Respect is what leads to value, which we've been talking about. And that's what everybody wants. We all want to feel valued by somebody else. And as I said, what's cool is that every and any moment in time, you can remind someone of their value. And when you do that, you increase your own value. Respect leads to value, and value leads to trust. And trust is what we're talking about. Because when you trust someone, you can be yourself. You can make mistakes without the fear that you're going to be judged as less valuable. And that's what the I am does. The I am becomes a roadmap for you. Why do I do what I do? Who am I? Why do I do what I do based on the influence of the four domains? Now, because the domains interconnect, a small change can have a big effect. That's the first truth of the I am. Small changes can have big effects. You don't need to change everything. As a psychiatrist, all my patient teachers learn this. And I call them my patient teachers because they're not just my patients. They teach me every day. It is the greatest honor and privilege to be working with someone in their time of need. They are my patient teachers. They all learn the I am. And whenever we add a medicine or change a medicine, they understand all we're doing is making a small change in the biological domain. You change the environment of those brain cells, you change their response. Nothing's broken. You've changed an environment, and now you change response. So, first truth, small changes can have big effects. But I think the second truth is even more powerful for everyone. Everyone has an I am. Everyone is interested in what you think or feel about them, which affects their biological domain, because you know it feels differently if you feel respected or disrespected. You know it feels different. And you're part of someone's home or social domain. So here's the second truth. You control no one, but you influence everyone. You get to choose the kind of influence you want to be. You control no one. You influence everyone. You will have an influence on people you will never meet. You go to a store, you buy some clothes. Somebody made those clothes somewhere. You're having an influence on those people that you will never meet. That's an incredible opportunity. Amazing responsibility. But when you use the I am approach, you can realize that that small change can have a big effect. And why not shift us so that we can use this? Instead of judging someone as less than, let's respect why they do what they do and wonder with them instead of worry. Let's wonder, why are they doing that? That's the I am approach.
That. And it's such a wonderfully empathetic approach. You know, that's the main thing I think I pick up from it. It can be a difficult balance in mental health conversations to talk about both the incredible challenges of mental illness and just how debilitating that can be, but also talk about the fact that there is always help to be found. There is always hope in even the darkest situations. And it can seem like those things are contradictory. And yet, what you're describing, I think, is a big part of why it does make sense, that someone can be in a position where they are doing their best, but that doesn't mean that can't change. And sometimes that's stuff internally to change. Sometimes that's external help. Whatever that first step is, like you say, it can be a small step, But even the smallest step will change the I am, because then it's a new best situation.
That's right. That's exactly it.
I love that. I also love what you said about trust. And it just made me think about what we were saying in terms of hopes for the future, in terms of stigma, and how wonderful it would be to go into any environment and trust that there wasn't going to be stigmatizing attitudes there. And I think, as massive as that can feel as a thing to achieve, I know that we are getting there because I come across environments all the time that have changed, you know, where new mental health policies come in certain workplaces and friend groups have conversations about mental health. Sometimes they write to me because listening to this show got a conversation going in, like you say, a group of people that I've never met. And so there are all these environments popping up where stigma is being stamped out. And so we are getting there. Progress is coming.
I agree with you. I agree with you. And the I am approach, as you're picking up, is not just about an individual. It's about a system. A system has an I am, right? A country has an I am. So I'm right now in the United States. This is the home domain of the United States. But we have our interaction with the global community. That's our social domain. We have an I see, the way we see ourselves now, the way other countries see us, which is different now than it was when George Washington was president. And then we have the biological domain, which are all of our resources, all of our people, and each of them has an I am. So you can take the I am and apply it at a systems level. Why are we doing this as a country? Why are we doing this as a species? Why are we doing this in a way that separates us, and then be astonished that we have war? Because as long as I am devaluing someone else, they're gonna be limbic. They will defend. And then I will go limbic, because I have to defend. Now you have two limbic brains. But when you step back and use the I am, you say, oh, well, that's why that's happening. What small change can I make? Just because I disagree with someone doesn't mean I disrespect them less. People need to understand that. That's why talking with people. You have a conversation. I don't have to agree with everything you say, but that doesn't mean I don't respect your point of view. Once you feel respected, you're not going to be limbic. You'll stay in that prefrontal cortex, and you can be able to think with someone and create with someone and invent with someone and move us to a different place. So that's what I'm hoping.
Absolutely, for sure. And so, sadly, we are coming to the end of our time. We might have to get you back on the show, because I definitely think we could chat all day very easily. But for the listeners, could you share a little bit about your upcoming book, which expands a lot more on this approach and this connection between respect, our mental health, and indeed so many elements of our lives?
So the book is called Unleashing the Power of Respect, the I Am Approach, and it will be available in bookstores all over the world, and Amazon and all of those places, sometime in February. Unleashing the Power of Respect, the I Am Approach. And what I've done is I have taken a series of stories by my patient teachers that illustrate different aspects of who we are. So there's a story about a person with bipolar, a story about a person with obsessive compulsive, a story about a person who had witnessed domestic violence, a story about a person who has Asperger's, a story about a person who was sexually abused inside the family. And then each story is followed by an I am perspective that explores what happened with this person, but also how it relates to us as a global community. The most difficult part of the I am is things like aggression and crime. How can those be the best someone can do? But when you lose the I am perspective, you don't have to judge that either. You don't have to like it, but you can understand it. So each chapter, each story is followed by an I Am perspective. And I really hope people read them. You know, I have a podcast too, the Dr. Joe Show, exploring who we are and why we do what we do. And it's all I Am based. And we are starting to read some of the little excerpts of the story as well. So if folks want to listen to that, I would be honored. Make sure you put in the I Am approach. Otherwise, you will get a Dr. Joe Show about cigars, which is not my show.
That is good to know. All right. Well, we will wrap up there. Absolutely. I look forward to hearing from listeners that enjoy your book and go and listen to your work further. And thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Bobby. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.